Welcome in, everybody, to the best in paranormal podcasting. This is Darkness Radio. I'm your host, Tim Dennis. It is a Wednesday. That means only one thing. It's time now for Supernatural News and Parashare. I'm your host, Tim Dennis. And you know what? I need a co-hostess for today, so that means only one thing. I'm going to reach my hand back out right across the Twin Cities metro area and pull out one of the best in the business. She's intelligent. She's witty. She's funny. She's got four books that are available right now at her website. We'll have a link in the description of this program so you can go get them. The Hindustan Times once called her the most dominant author on our charts. Of course, we don't know how many authors there are on their charts, but hey, we're not counting. Ladies and gentlemen, here she is, Jessica Freeberg. Jess, how are you?
Hey, I think I'm the only one, actually. It's just me.
Is it just you? I wouldn't discount yourself.
It's very lonely at the top.
Is it? Well, but you're on the top. So there you go.
I'm the bottom, technically, since I'm the only one.
Well, it's you. There you go.
It's me.
The dominator of Hindustan Times world.
I need that on a t-shirt or a coffee cup or something. Actually, it needs to be emblazoned on something I can see.
Dominator of charts. Eater of worlds, Jessica Freeberg. Yeah.
That's me.
That's you. See? Big show today, folks. You know, last week was insane with different stories. We had the UAP that was fired upon, or you know, the video of it at least, that came from Capitol Hill. And then on top of that, you had the Conjuring House stuff that happened. Not only was the Conjuring movie Last Rites released the weekend before, and then there was the little bit of backlash that came from the people who were actually involved, their story, and them saying, well, you know, good movie, horrible premise. The fact that, you know, our family histories have nothing to do with the way it was written in the movie. But then on top of it, it was announced that the Conjuring House was going up for auction on Halloween.
Yeah, I saw that.
Yeah. So, I mean, big news week last week. I mean, huge news week last week. This week, no exception. Because this week, the government comes out and says, you know what? We think we found the clearest sign of life on Mars. Okay. So
wow.
We're still advancing. We're still going forward. Not only that, but also this week in the news, Dr. Jeff Meldrum passes away. Big time Bigfoot researcher. I mean, he's been all over paranormal television. This is the researcher that basically came out and made it acceptable to say, you know what, Bigfoot exists. He's out there. And he was the first one that I think really science started to take seriously. So we'll talk about Dr. Jeff Meldrum and his life today. Just a huge week, another huge week. And these are, like I was telling Mally last week, Jess, these are stories that are out there that I think 10, 15 years ago, we're getting hit with these stories that would have absolutely set us on our ear. Now it's kind of like, oh yeah, you know, this happened. You know, it doesn't have the impact that it might've had 10, 15 years ago. I don't know why. I don't know why these are becoming such mundane stories now, but maybe we've been desensitized in some
way. Nate, is the world just getting weirder and weirder? So we're just like, oh, okay.
It could be. Maybe.
You know, we've lived through some crazy times. So maybe we're just.
Maybe the bar keeps getting higher and higher and we just, it is what it is, right?
And maybe once the world shuts down for months, everything else is like, whatever.
Yeah. I mean, you know, we saw a pandemic. What could be worse, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's start it off with that said story about Mars and the fact that the U.S. government comes out and says, you know what? Sean Duffy stands at a podium and says, we think we have the clearest sign of life yet on Mars, and points to a rock. Not Iraq, the country, but a rock, and says, this is it right here. Let's explain what it is you're looking at. NASA has announced the discovery of what it believes to be ancient microbial life on Mars. The new administrator for the space agency, Sean Duffy, said a sample collected by the Perseverance rover has been declared the clearest sign of life ever found on the red planet. In a news conference last Wednesday, NASA's associate administrator, Nikki Fox, said this is kind of signature that we would, it's the kind of signature we would see that was made by something biological. Specifically, researchers have been looking at unusual spots and seed-like shapes in ancient Martian rocks that might point to the existence of tiny life forms in the distant past. These features, nicknamed poppy seeds and leopard spots, were spotted in mud-like rocks in Neretva Vallis, part of the Jezero crater, where a river existed billions of years ago. Scientist Joel Hurwitz revealed that how these tiny signatures found in the crater pointed to the existence of life on Mars long before most organisms emerged on Earth. Although the findings have been discussed for months, Hurwitz noted that scientists needed to gather more data from Neretva Vallis and confirm the results with other researchers before releasing the conclusion that this could be Martian life. "We're here to say this is exciting and we want to share the news. This could be very real," Duffy continued. The rover's tools detected chemicals like iron and phosphorus in these spots, which can form when tiny microbes break down organic material, which is a sign of life here on Earth. The NASA robot has been beaming back images to Earth since 2021, revealing crystalline solids left over from water flowing on the surface of Mars, and a reddish area that contained organic compounds and an energy source for what could have been microbial life. Perseverance collected the new life-proving rocks on July 21st of 2024 while exploring the northern edge of Neretva Vallis, the ancient river valley formed roughly 3.7 billion years ago. Scientists noticed the vein-like structures throughout, finding that they were white calcium sulfate. The crystalline solids on the Martian surface are hard water deposits left behind by ancient groundwater flowing through the now dusty landscape. Between those veins were bands of material with a reddish color, suggesting the presence of hematite, one of the minerals that gives Mars its distinctive rusty hue. Duffy noted that the announcement on Wednesday was the culmination of 30 years of research on the red planet. He added that the latest findings went through a peer review process, just like the scientific studies in all fields, which proved the samples likely had a biological origin. When asked if NASA plans to retrieve the potential organic samples from Mars, Duffy said the space agency was still looking at how and when they could get the rocks back to Earth, adding that we're going to look at our budgets. Here comes that dirty word, budgets, which is always fun in science, right?
Yes. They're always raining on our parade with money talk.
That's right. The new administrator appointed by President Trump noted that the president loves space and believed NASA has the money to complete its work, which is now focused on manned space missions. Duffy noted the space agency's mission was going to be a little more focused, but felt comfortable asking the White House for more funding, and it was needed to be confirmed or needed to confirm the findings on Mars. At no point has this administration said we don't care about samples, Fox added, while addressing questions about NASA's changing priorities regarding Mars exploration. Previously, the Trump administration had cut the Mars sample retrieval mission from its budget proposal for NASA. So this was not a part of it. It was part of $6 billion that was slashed from NASA's future budget in the May proposal to Congress, even though the ongoing sample study had already cost billions. Duffy said NASA was now looking at a faster, more cost-effective way of getting Perseverance's samples back for examination. As for NASA's upcoming space missions, well, Duffy revealed that four astronauts will circle the moon early next year as part of the Artemis II lunar mission. "We're going back to the moon," the administrator declared. Duffy added that about a year and a half after the Artemis II mission, the Artemis III mission astronauts, or the Artemis III astronaut mission, will land and establish a long-term presence of life on the moon led by America. NASA's new leader continued by saying that the astronauts learn from the renewed missions to the moon and will help in future efforts to put American boots back on Mars, or put American boots on Mars, not back on Mars, but put American boots on Mars. So with that, Jess, not in the budget initially. They slashed $6 billion out of the budget. They said it's not important. And all of a sudden it's important. Now they found something that says, you know what, there may be life there. With that being said, do you put it back in the budget? Or do you think they can find a cheaper way?
It's definitely one of those things that if you can say, hey, I'm responsible for finding life on Mars or proving there was life on Mars, that's a pretty big bragging point. So it might put it back in.
It can be, but do you think there's actually anything up there that's actually alive other than microbes?
I don't know. I'd like to think that if we keep looking, we'll find some little cute critter that pops out with like three eyes and all these extra arms for hugging.
True. No, you never know. Never know.
You never know.
Yeah. NASA has played down the idea that an interstellar visitor was made by aliens. Of course, we're talking again about 3i Atlas, or that little comet. I still think it's a comet or potential spaceship that is barreling through space, so to speak. There have been numerous rumors in recent weeks concerning the nature of that interstellar comet. Harvard astronomer Avi Loeb raised eyebrows recently when he suggested that the object, which has been traveling at high speed through our solar system, might be an artificially constructed probe sent by an extraterrestrial civilization to explore our region of space. Arguments in favor of this conclusion include the probe's suspiciously direct trajectory through the inner solar system as its curious composition, and the fact that it seems to be producing its own light. If future data will indicate the absence of a cometary tail, we will be faced with the tantalizing possibility that it did not inherit a random velocity in interstellar space, but instead was sent towards the inner solar system by design, Loeb wrote. The consequences, should the hypothesis turn out to be correct, could potentially be dire for humanity. It would possibly require defensive measures to be undertaken, though these might prove futile. Well, seeing the video from last week, you can't fire on a UAP. It doesn't work.
Right.
Now, though, NASA has moved to play down suggestions that 3i Atlas was built by aliens. Following extensive study and observation of the object, scientists believe it poses no threat to the Earth and that there's no reason to believe that it was artificially constructed. It looks like a comet. It does comet things. It very, very strongly resembles it in just about every way, the comets that we know, said NASA scientist Tom Statler. It sounds like they're trying to get out of paying billions to look closer at this thing is what it sounds like, is my guess.
It looks like a comet and quacks like a comet. Oh, wait.
It's probably a quacking comet. Yeah. Yeah. It has some interesting properties that are a bit different from our solar system comets, but it behaves like a comet, Statler said. And so the evidence is overwhelmingly pointing to this object being a natural body. It's a comet, he went on to say. Believed to be up to 3.5 miles wide, the object is traveling at 130,000 miles per hour. I mean, that thing is cooking.
Wow.
It's moving. It's moving. Statler also said, I keep saying Statler, and I think Statler and Waldorf from the Muppets, the two the two critics. So I keep expecting him to go, ah, comets are a mixture of dust and ice. They're also being heated by the sun. That heating is changing, he said, and exactly how they respond to that is something that's a bit unpredictable. He also said, so even in our solar system, comets can have a history of suddenly brightening if there's, say, a particular pocket of ice that sublimates quickly and drives off a large amount of dust. In other words, he thinks it's a comet.
He said that a few times.
Yeah. He's like, it's a comet, it's a comet, it's a comet. By the way, did you learn it's a comet? Because we think it's
a comet.
He's like,
do you think if I just keep telling them it's a comet, eventually they'll stop asking?
Probably not, because Avi Loeb is out there saying, it's an alien, it's an alien, it's an alien. So the fight continues until this thing turns around and hits us with a laser, I guess. I have no idea.
Oh, gosh.
There's an article out there that asks the question, how realistic are the alien species in the TV show Alien Earth? There's three scientists out there that are posing the question. Thomas Hayworth, Chris Duffy, and Jen Bright. They say the TV series Alien Earth has introduced a number of new creatures to the much-loved, albeit terrifying, alien franchise. But how realistic are the new aliens? That's the new question that they have, that trio of scientists. They've tried to tackle it with a ranking. Yes, they ranked them. To be clear, they're not trying to find flaws in the show. Like many fans, they're simply having some fun using science to analyze the creatures. This is how they ranked them. They said, all species in the series draw inspiration from real living organisms and processes seen on Earth, but crank it up to the extreme. They therefore won't explore all those parallels, but instead focus on how plausible the organisms are in terms of underlying processes such as physics, chemistry, metabolism, and evolution. So to give you an idea just real quickly of how they rank them, I'll tell you real quick how they rank them. They say number one is the tick. They say their most plausible creature is the large blood-sucking tick. On Earth, the deer tick does swell into the size of a walnut when feeding, which is not too different from the alien Earth tick. In the show, we see it attack the jugular and quickly take on a couple of pints of blood. The perhaps surprisingly quick death of the unfortunate prey most likely results from hemorrhagic shock due to how quickly the blood is lost. It is possible that some sort of chemical agent, perhaps an anticoagulant, has repeatedly evolved in blood predators on Earth, is also injected. We do see a defense mechanism in episode 5 where the ticks release an airborne toxin to prevent them from being removed from their host. Chemical defenses like poisons and venoms are common in animals and plants on Earth to deter predators. So the tick is number one. Number two, Diplumacare, or the plant pot. This creature, which was discovered and named in the show by the crew of the USCSS Maginot, benefits from not only having been seen much at the stage of writing, they say they have viewed the first 6 episodes. As the series progresses, it could move down the list, but initially the character Kirsch questions whether it is flora or fauna. The science officer's analysis ultimately shows that they classify it as a carnivorous plant. The green color could indicate that it also uses chlorophyll the way that photosynthetic organisms like plants on Earth do. However, a near spherical body is in fact the worst structure for photosynthesis, so it has its flaws. It lacks any surface area enhancing adaptations you'd expect from a photosynthetic organism, such as leaves. This would also be particularly important given it appears to hang underneath covering structures like cave roofs. Perhaps this is why it needs to capture prey rather than evolving more efficient light capturing mechanisms. It instead alternates between photosynthesis and predation, depending on the resources available. Number three is, boy, forgive me on this one. My sciencey terms is not so good. Trypanohyacinia ocellus. I know that one. I know what ocellus is. T. ocellus is the lovable little eyeball octopus parasite. It attacks its host, removing an eyeball, and then takes over entirely via connections to the brain. Sounds like a cute little animal.
That sounds terrible.
Doesn't it? This may seem like pure science fiction, but there are parasites on Earth that replace body parts and even control their host's behavior. However, the latter are usually relatively simple organisms, like the, oh my gosh, this is a holy balls type of word, the Ophiocordyceps fungus. I nailed that one.
I'm dead. I don't want that, though. That sounds icky.
Yeah. That takes over the brain of another animal and is a necessary part of their life cycle. The behavioral changes these parasites induce are simple, such as moving the host towards the light, water, or the scent of a predator. Toxoplasma gondii is an example of a parasite that alters the behavior of mice, making them less avoidant of the smell of cat urine. The infected mice are therefore more likely to be eaten by cats, which then spread long-lasting parasite spores in their feces. Did you know about that one?
No. First, I was thinking that's a really dumb parasite to try to get its host eaten, but then you went with the next part and it gets spread all over by cats. I'm like, dang, that's brilliant. He could take over the world if he was a person.
Pretty ingenious, huh? Gives you a whole new way of looking at Tom and Jerry. T. ocellus, in contrast, is very mobile, highly intelligent, and strong, showing behavior like monitoring situations and distracting humans. The behavior is plausible with distributed ganglia, which is a great band name, distributed ganglia. It's hard to say, though, when you go to announce them on stage. Clusters of nerve cells, by the way, in the tentacles, similar to octopi. Okay. The fly, first seen in episode 6, the fly appears to consume metal and metal ores, and it pre-digests its food by spitting an enzyme, similar to flies on Earth. Their main issue with it is that it's unclear whether it is a supplement such as iron or other trace elements in our diet or main energy source. We'll leave that one for, they have a long explanation for that. The xenomorph. Xenomorph might come off or come in at the bottom of this plausibility ranking, but it takes the top spot in their hearts or chests. The main problem with it is impossibly fast growth rates, transitioning from a relatively small chest burster to a fully grown adult in a very short period of time. How could you have problems with the xenomorph? That's like the most popular alien ever.
I think it's the cutest one.
Most definitely. Very crudely, if we assume it has a similar metabolic efficiency to humans and that it weighs roughly 100 kilograms, then it would need to consume and convert millions of calories of food over a ton of pork-like meat in what seems like to be a few days at most. Of course, it would have a much higher metabolic efficiency than humans, though it would always be bound by the conservation of mass and energy. You can't acquire more biomass than you consume, and we would never see it eat, not even its initial host. I think these guys are thinking too hard about this, you know?
Yeah, they're really hyperanalyzing it.
Yeah, you don't need to do that. But that's how they rank. That's how they rank those particular things, which is interesting.
But that's fun.
Yeah, a little bit of a fun
one. I like that.
There's an asteroid approaching us, Jess. It's a once
in
a... Well, not, it's not going to kill us. But,
oh, okay.
But we may have a chance to look at it as it passes us. Yeah. It's called a once-in-a-millennium event, the approach of the potentially hazardous asteroid Apophis. Will be visible to the naked eye. Now, I say potentially hazardous because it has a 1 in a million chance of actually hitting us. It's not going to. But in 2029, the asteroid Apophis will skim safely past Earth where it will be visible to billions. For scientists, it's a once in a millennium planetary experiment. That's for sure. When the potentially hazardous asteroid 99942 Apophis makes its breathtakingly close flyby of Earth on April 13th of 2029, more than 2 billion people across Africa and Western Europe will be able to watch it drift across the night sky. Under clear skies, a space rock will be appearing to everyone as a faint star, about as bright as the stars in the Big Dipper and easily visible to the unaided eye, gliding steadily overhead. Apophis flyby will mark the first time in space history that a potentially hazardous asteroid is visible to the naked eye. That, according to Richard Binzel, who is a professor of planetary sciences at MIT. He said that during a keynote address at the Europlanet Science Congress in Helsinki, Finland, astronomers estimate that a close approach by an asteroid this large, which is 1,100 feet across, or roughly the height of the Eiffel Tower, occurs only once every 7,500 years. For the public, it will be a dazzling once-in-a-lifetime spectacle. For scientists, it promised something even more rare, once-in-a-millennium natural experiment to watch in real time how Earth's gravity reshapes a massive asteroid. We don't know, Binzel said, and we won't know until we look. Binzel, a pioneer in asteroid hazard research and the inventor of the Torino Impact Hazard Scale that's used to rate impact risks of asteroids and comets, underscored one point above all. If you take nothing else away from this, I want you to take away these three things, he said in this during his presentation. Apophis will safely pass the Earth. Apophis will safely pass the Earth. Apophis will safely pass the Earth. So it's going to safely pass the Earth, Jess. We don't have to worry about it.
All right. I'll check it off my list of things to have anxiety about.
Yeah, yeah. Don't get yourself worked up about that, dude. You're going to be fine. You're definitely going to be fine. All right. And I believe, next to finally, there's one other story here. After this one, if I can get this one to, again, populate. It's that time in the show where the iPad decides, there we go. A potentially habitable exoplanet with an atmosphere is discovered out there. The James Webb Telescope has identified a planet in a star's habitable zone with a possible atmosphere. According to Hannah Wakeford and Ryan McDonald, new research using NASA's powerful James Webb Space Telescope has identified a planet 41 light years away, which may have an atmosphere. Now, we talked about this a couple weeks ago, which is surprising why I pulled this story. But it's a little bit more of an in-depth story about that planet. So I tell you what, I'm going to post this to the description of the program. So if you guys want to read more about it, this habitable exoplanet, you can. But it's interesting because it talks about typically what a day in the life of this planet is like in the atmosphere of this planet. It's a little sketchy as to, they don't believe we'd be able to move to this planet by any means. That's only 41 light years away.
But it's inhabitable by other organisms, just not us.
It might be, yes. Yes, it does. Okay. It does allow for liquid water on the planet's surface. It does have those conditions. So if where there's water, there can be life. So it's a Goldilocks zone. So. I'm saying there's a chance. That's right. I'm going to show you a house here, Jess. And this is our final story before break. And you tell me, first of all, it's a house where somebody famous lived. Okay.
Okay.
And it's called the Mothership. All right. And I want you to tell me, first of all, would you buy it?
Ooh. It's pretty cool. It does look like a spaceship.
It does, doesn't it? And
I might buy it.
How much would you pay for it?
Depends on where it's located.
Okay. Just give me a ballpark. If I told you somebody famous lived in it.
Okay. Well, it's got to be a few million. So I would say $7 million.
Okay. That's a pretty good shot. Pretty good guess. You're getting good at this Price is Right thing with famous.
You're making me. You make me guess all the time.
I want you to take a look at this. Here's the picture of the inside. One of the pictures of the inside there. Take a look at that.
Ooh, I like it. I mean, it doesn't feel very homey, but it's pretty cool.
But it's a good novelty home, right? I mean, if you had some...
Yeah, second home, your $7 million second home.
Yeah, yeah. Believe it or not, the home is only $5.5 million.
I think we could scrape some money together and buy that.
I think we could, yeah.
Darkness Radio headquarters.
That's right. We just got to get some of that feet money together from you, and then we can go out and buy it.
I know. Imagine the parties we could throw there and the cool foot pics we could take around the house.
Right? In the mothership.
Does it have an indoor pool?
Oh, let me find that out for you here. The home, which is called the Mothership, was owned by this man. Do you know who that is?
Who is that? He looks familiar.
That's Jackie Gleason.
Oh, come on. Really?
Yep.
He owns that? That's amazing.
Jackie Gleason had a lifelong love affair with UFOs and aliens. And had this...
At least one of us.
Yeah. And he had this home built. And
I would definitely buy it then. That's so cool.
Yeah. It's his former spaceship-inspired home, and he called it the Mothership. It's in Westchester County in New York, and it's back on the market. And it's at a discount. $5.5 million listing was specially commissioned by the late comedian and musician as an escape from filming The Honeymooners. So he had this house when he was filming The Honeymooners.
Left him in the Honeymooners.
Yeah. Gleason is a well-known UFO and paranormal aficionado and dubbed his circular Cortland Manor home the mothership. The property hasn't traded hands since the 1970s, so somebody's had it all this time. It was unsuccessfully listed for $12 million in 2018, and people weren't able to unload it then. The property's comedic cachet is matched by its architectural chops. Robert Sika, a student of Frank Lloyd Wright, oversaw every detail of the ambitious engineering project. The endeavor to erect the spaceship on stilts reportedly took $650,000 and several years to build. Now keep that in mind. Back in the days when the Honeymooners was being filmed, $650,000 was a fortune. But that's how much it cost to build that home.
Wow.
Gleason's network bosses at CBS footed the bill, according to Gleason's 1987 obituary. So CBS built it for him.
Wow, that's so cool.
Isn't it?
We're in the wrong business.
Right? I'm going to tell you something after this story that'll also tell you why we're also in the wrong business. It's insane.
Meanwhile, Tim and I are over here trying to figure out how we can sell feet pictures to make more money, and he's getting a house built for him.
Yeah, by CBS. At least some of its assembly took place inside of an airplane hangar, according to reports, under the care of a Scandinavian shipbuilder. That's how specialized this house is. Everything is curved. Take a look at this, Jess. You want to talk about things that'll make you salivate? This is the bar inside the house. Tell me this isn't.
Oh my gosh.
Tell me it's not a party house.
We need this house. This literally, I'm not kidding. It needs to be our headquarters.
Right? That's something. The bar in this house is exquisite. I mean, it's something else. The investment paid off in 1959. Sika had produced an enduring architectural marvel, and Gleason was ready to enjoy it. Rumored guests of the home's three bars, there's three bars in this place, Jess, three bars in the spaceship, and marble dance floor, there's a marble dance floor in it, include Frank Sinatra, Marilyn Monroe, and Richard Nixon. Nixon was a longtime golfing buddy of Gleason, supposedly, and we had a guest on the show that told the story of when Nixon took Gleason to see the alien bodies in Washington. I'll have to see if I can find the episode. If I can find the episode, I'll put the link in the description of the program so you can listen to the episode again, because it's really, really interesting listening. Nixon was a longtime golfing buddy of Gleason. The pair feature in a well-circulated conspiracy theory in which they encountered extraterrestrials of their own. That was actually just Nixon asking Gleason, do you want to see alien bodies? I believe he took him out to Area 51, if I remember right. He either took him to Area 51 or he took him down into the, was it to Capitol Hill when they were down in the basement? I'm trying to remember what the story is, but
now, either way.
Yeah. Again, if I have the link for the program, I'll put it in the description so you can hear the whole story. The only confirmed flying saucer connected to Gleason sits in the Hudson Valley, however, and it's rooted firmly on the ground. And again, you buy it for $5.5 million. The 3,950 square foot residence is a mid-century time capsule under a copper roof. There's not a right angle in sight. The shower, the study, the furniture, the cabinets, and even the 8-foot bed are all neatly rounded. Everything is round. That's trippy. Floor-to-ceiling windows fill the circular space with light, complementing the impressive craftsmanship above. The home's exposed wooden ceiling trusses resemble rowboats, and some of the vents resemble stylized fish, the shipbuilder's touch. The marble fireplaces and floors come with their own unbelievable tales. It is reported that Gleason purchased an entire Italian quarry in order to secure the best marble, and his resulting fireplaces were so massive that they required delivery via helicopter. Now that's impressive.
Very cool.
The extraterrestrial getaway sits on 8.6 acres of solid Hudson Valley ground, about an hour's drive north of New York City. Here's a picture of one of the exposures there on the outside.
Wow. That's it's just the coolest looking house.
Yeah. Yeah. That would be something. See, that's one of those, you ever hit the lottery, that's one of those houses you could just go buy.
Yeah, just to have. Just for fun.
Here's another exposure of the house. But it's one of those.
And that looks normal.
Yeah, that looks like a normal house, doesn't it?
Right, you pull up to that and you're like, oh, cool house. And then you go around the other side and you're like, oh my God, it's a spaceship.
Yeah, from one side, from one exposure, it just looks like a cozy little cottage. And then you go around the other side and you're like, what in the hell am I looking at, right?
It's the mothership.
See, you go around. This is elsewhere on the 8.6 acre property. There's a mini mothership that can be used for camping, right? There's a little cottage.
Oh my gosh.
Look at that. So you can have somebody.
I need to sell a kid or something. I need this house.
So there's like a little mini mothership that you can have people stay at on the property. Look at
I sell one kid and a kidney, and what else can I sell, Tim?
Look at how expansive that is, Jess.
Oh, it's so beautiful, and it's in the trees, and there's like some hills around.
Look at that, huh? That's something. I mean, and to think that a network built that for one star.
And yeah, just because he was so awesome.
Yeah. Two other guest houses sit elsewhere on the property. A smaller spaceship that I just showed Jess. You can see it on the video, used as a bunkhouse and glamping site. And the barracks, which is a 1930s stone house. Gleason, a native of Bedford Stuy, sold the unique home back to CBS, rather, when he relocated to Miami in the 1960s. Gleason resided in Florida until his death in 1987 at the age of 71. The property changed hands twice more, last trading for $150,000 in 1976. Can you believe it only sold for $150,000 in 1976?
Literally insane.
Yeah. Corcoran agent Heidi Henshaw holds the current listing. So, house is gorgeous. It's just gorgeous. It's just one of those things where you want to get a hold of it. All right. Coming up in the program, ChatGPT has entered the Darwin Awards. We'll tell you about it. It's an interesting story. I think it's funny that it's being recognized that way. Dr. Jeff Meldrum passed away this past week, anthropologist and Bigfoot researcher. We'll tell you about the circumstances regarding that and his life. A ghost was caught on doorbell camera as it walked away from a cemetery. We'll talk to you about that story. As one cryptozoologist exits, another enters. We'll tell you about a teenage cryptozoologist who is new on the scene and making waves. So we'll talk to you about that cryptozoologist as well. And our palate cleanser for today. I finally have a way to distinguish one chipmunk from another in my yard. I'll tell you how I'm going to do it in our palate cleanser today. So that's coming up. That's it. Today on the program, all that when we come back right here on The Best in Paranormal Podcasting. It's a Supernatural News and Parashare Wednesday right here on The Best in Paranormal Podcasting. This is Darkness Radio.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care. Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Mr. Monopoly here. Monopoly is back at McDonald's. Register in the McDonald's app so you're ready to...
get your bag!
Two ways to peel for a chance to...
get your bag!
Physical peels with select items and digital peels with others to...
get your bag!
Play Monopoly at McDonald's.
Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
No purchase necessary. See rules at playmcd.com for full details and amoe.playmcd.com to play without purchase. Ends November 23rd, but bonus play ends November 2nd. Monopoly is a registered trademark of Hasbro. Copyright McDonald's.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Welcome back to the Best in Paranormal Podcasting. This is Darkness Radio on a Wednesday. Supernatural News and Parashare. Tim Dennis and Jessica Freeberg with you. And Jess, a pretty good weekend this weekend. I think I had a pretty... You know what? I actually had a weekend this weekend.
Yay! Yeah. You deserve it.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. But yeah, I got together with the boys from Extreme Pro Wrestling Radio. We went to the Twins game. And learned that a... child of a certain age can produce gas like an old man who hasn't had a vegetable in about 3 decades and can really stink out a stadium.
Oh, yeah. Little boys are gross.
Oh, God. I got to hold my little great nephew for the first time.
Oh.
Yep. So congratulations.
So cute.
He's a little cutie. So congratulations to my nephew and niece, Tyler and Maya. So that's congratulations on little Bennett. So, yeah, he's welcome to the family, Bennett.
Yeah, and not to rush things, but you should totally have more kids because he is adorable.
He is, yeah, yeah, yeah. He's a little cutie. And I found out he's a good luck charm. He managed to single-handedly, the minute he showed up to his uncle's football game, not mine, I wasn't playing football this weekend, but to my nephew's football game, They were tied nothing. They magically won 14-0. And they were getting pounded. I mean, they were getting pounded up and down the field. It was scoreless, but it was looking like they weren't going to win. But all of a sudden they dominated the football game. And the only explanation I have, little Bennett came on the scene in his little stroller.
Yep. He's their lucky piece.
That's right. There you go. So overall, good weekend. Made me happy. That's for sure. I did it again. I shouldn't have said the word. The minute I do that, the music starts, and that means it's time to start the segment. So we'll just learn about AI, and we'll move on. So, AI. North Korea. They're a thorn in everyone's side. And evidently now they're a thorn in South Korea's side. Now that they've discovered ChatGPT. That's right. A suspected North Korean state-sponsored hacking group used ChatGPT to create a deepfake of a military ID document to attack a target in South Korea. That, according to cybersecurity researchers, attackers used the artificial intelligence tool to craft a fake draft of a South Korean military identification card in order to create a realistic-looking image meant to make a phishing attempt seem more credible. That, according to research published this past weekend by Genians, which is a South Korean cybersecurity firm. Instead of including a real image, the email linked to malware capable of extracting data from recipients' devices. Oh, you crafty. The group responsible for the attack, which researchers have dubbed Kim Suki, is a suspected North Korean sponsored cyber espionage unit, previously linked to other spying efforts against South Korean targets. The U.S. Department of Homeland Security called Kim Suki, or said Kim Suki is most likely tasked by the North Korean regime with a global intelligence gathering mission, according to a 2020 advisory. The findings by Genians in July are the latest example of suspected North Korean operatives deploying AI as part of their intelligence gathering work. Anthropic said in August it discovered North Korean hackers used the Claude Code tool to get hired and work remotely for U.S. Fortune 500 tech companies. In that case, Claude helped them build up elaborate fake identities, pass coding assessments, and deliver actual technical work once hired. OpenAI representatives didn't immediately respond to a request for comment outside normal business hours. The company said in February it had banned suspected North Korean accounts that had used the service to create fraudulent resumes, cover letters, and social media posts to try recruiting people to aid their schemes. The trend shows that hackers and attackers can leverage emerging AI during the hacking process, including attack scenario planning, malware development, building their tools to impersonate job recruiters, said Mun Chong Yun, who is the director at Genians. Now, phishing targets in this latest cybercrime spree include South Korean journalists and researchers and human rights activists focused on North Korea. It's also sent from an email address ending in in.mli.kr, which is an impersonation of a South Korean military address. Exactly how many victims were breached wasn't immediately clear. So,
well, that's terrifying.
Yeah. Go ChatGPT.
We're not going to be able to trust anything anymore. I mean, everything could be fake.
It could be. And we're getting to We're getting to that point where it's hard to trust anything. But with that, Jess, with the terrifying comes the funny. Meanwhile, the AI Darwin Awards launch is celebrating spectacularly bad deployments. Everything from fast food fiascos to botched databases. There's fresh honors for machine learning misadventures in this year's Darwin Awards. You know what was bound to happen? The Darwin Awards are being extended to include examples of misadventures involving overzealous applications of AI. Nominations are open for the 2025 AI Darwin Awards, and the list of contenders is growing, fueled by a tech world weary of AI and evangelists eager to shove it somewhere inappropriate. There's the Taco Bell drive-thru incident, where the chain catastrophically overestimated AI's ability to understand customer orders. That's always fun. I don't know if you've tried ordering from their AI services or not. Or the Replit moment, where a spot of vibe coding nuked a production database despite instructions from the user not to fiddle with code without permission. That's always fun. Then there's the woeful security surrounding an AI chatbot used to screen applicants at McDonald's, where feeding in a password of 123456 gave access to the details of 64 million job applicants.
Oh, no.
That was all the password was, Jess. 1 through 6. Yeah. Do you think an old guy made up the password?
Yeah, someone who couldn't remember any more gosh darn passwords.
Or they had to give out the password to a lot of people.
Yeah.
The Darwin Awards have traditionally been handed out in a virtual sense to individuals who have managed to remove themselves from the gene pool as a result of their own stupidity. The AI Darwin Awards instead are a collection of cautionary tales where an ill-conceived application of AI resulted in disaster. The awards are not about poking fun at AI itself, but the consequences of its application without due care and attention. Artificial intelligence is just a tool like a chainsaw, nuclear reactor, or particularly aggressive blender. It's not the chainsaw's fault when someone decides to juggle it at a dinner party, the organizers say.
Fair point.
AI systems themselves are innocent victims in this whole affair. They're just following their programming, like a very enthusiastic puppy that happens to have access to global infrastructure and the ability to make decisions at the speed of light. The Register runs a weekly column of IT whoopsies called Who Me? As such, we wholly endorse this approach to documenting the poor decision-making behind fiascos blamed on AI. So look for the AI Darwin Awards coming soon.
Yep. It's not AI's fault. It's our fault for using it stupidly.
That's right. That's right. Okay, switching gears here. Some sad news this past week, at the end of the week, as we found out, and it was, I mean, obviously overshadowed with the assassination of Charlie Kirk, also on that same day, believe it or not, anthropologist and Bigfoot researcher Jeff Meldrum died at the age of 67. Dr. Meldrum was an expert on primate movements and foot morphology, skills that he applied to the Bigfoot mystery. And before Dr. Meldrum, I mean, you had cryptozoologists like, and you still do, like Lauren Coleman. You have others that bring science to the field and try to advance the field. But Dr. Meldrum was a professor of anatomy and anthropology in the Department of Biological Sciences at Idaho State University, and perhaps best known for his many contributions to the Bigfoot phenomena, about which he authored the book Sasquatch, Legend Meets Science in 2006. Unlike many Bigfoot researchers, he was able to use his knowledge of anthropology to offer an analytical approach to the study of alleged Bigfoot footprints and to determining how much such a creature might move. Throughout his life, he believed that Bigfoot is indeed a real creature and added an element of authenticity to the field thanks to his academic background. It is with profound sadness that the Meldrum family shares that Dr. Meldrum has passed following a battle with brain cancer, his widow wrote on Facebook on September 11th. She also went on to say the illness was brief and he passed with family at his side. He loved teaching and researching Bigfoot, but he was a husband and father first. She went on to say, I am so grateful to have shared the last 17 years of my life with him. He was a force of nature. Please respect our privacy and our time of grief. Now, Dr. Meldrum was an honored guest, a well-loved guest of this show. The last appearance he was on, it's been a few years since he's been on. He was on in 2019 last when the show was Beyond the Darkness. You know what? I may go back and post the link as well for Dr. Meldrum, his last appearance in the description of this program, because I think it's important to go back and listen to that show as well. But
yeah, I think that would be awesome.
Yeah. So rest in peace, Dr. Meldrum. Again, just a huge presence in the cryptozoological field, and he's gone way too soon. So, and I had sent out a post when Dr. Meldrum died, just asking people to kind of keep his family and your thoughts and prayers and send them energy, whatever your process may be, but continue to keep them in your thoughts and prayers. And it's just, it's a difficult time right now for the Meldrum family. So if you'd do that, that'd be greatly appreciated. All right. Our next story has to do with a ghost who was caught on a doorbell camera as it walked away from a cemetery. The apparition activated Shane's camera as it appeared to walk along the road. Footage. Here we go. I've got ads are a wonderful thing. 42-year-old Shane Irwin said the doorbell at his home notified him just before 8 p.m. on Thursday to someone at his front door. But when he checked the footage back, he was shocked to see that nobody was there until he spotted what he believes was a ghostly apparition. Self-proclaimed horror fan Shane says this is made even spookier by the fact that he lives opposite of a cemetery. He said the doorbell notified me that someone was at my door and I didn't see anything at first. Then I spotted it. I rewatched it probably for about 15 minutes and it was so cool. I was amazed, he said. Right there across the street is a cemetery. I am very interested in horror. I love ghosts and the paranormal. So I thought it was amazing. I definitely think it was a ghost. It is not a time of day when there is fog, he went on to say. is just too perfect to be anything else. You don't usually see stuff like this happening in the daytime. I have seen videos like this on the internet, but it is always at night and really faint. This is very clear. I showed my sister and a few of my friends who believe in ghosts, and they said I definitely captured something. Let me see. Is there a video? Yeah, there is a video attached to this. So I'll post this one as well so that you can watch the video attached to this and see the video for yourself. Psychic medium John Edward is, I believe, scheduled to be in the Twin Cities here in October doing readings. He has a brand new book out with FBI agent Robert Hilland. Now, what was it, a decade and a half ago, he was under some fire. People thought maybe he was wearing an earpiece.
Mm-hmm, I remember that.
Yeah, he was being fed answers and gallery readings. He was scrutinized quite a bit for that. But there's a new book out, and this FBI agent says John Edward is the real deal. Not only that, but he's helping in an unorthodox way to help fight crime. He's helping the FBI. FBI Special Agent Robert Hilland reluctantly reached out to psychic John Edward in 1998 for help on a tough case, and he had no idea that his life would change forever at that point. Hilland and Edward opened up about their unusual journey fighting crime with the help of Edward's spirit guides in their new book, Chasing Evil. The book tells the story of some of the most high-profile cases that they have tackled together and the people that they have helped and the deep bond that they now share. On the morning of September 8th, 2009, a 24-year-old Yale University graduate by the name of Annie Lee was nowhere to be found. She had vanished. Lee was working toward a PhD in pharmacology, was last seen on surveillance video, entering a research building on the university's sprawling New Haven, Connecticut campus, but was never seen leaving. Authorities launched a massive search for the 4'11" bride-to-be, who disappeared in just five days before her wedding to her long-term fiancé, leaving behind only blood droplets and a strand of hair in the lab where she had been attacked. The sensational case quickly became headline news, with media outlets racing to report every detail they could dig up about the shocking murder that rocked the prestigious Ivy League school. But one part of the story has been kept under wraps from the public and even the FBI until now. Authorities found Lee's remains on September 12th of 2009 inside a wall in the basement of a five-story research building with the help of longtime FBI Special Agent Robert Hilland and renowned psychic medium John Edward. On the second day that Lee went missing, Edward called Hilland from Ireland, where he was traveling at the time, frenetically directing him to a specific spot in the building. True to form, John lit up, Hilland told people. It was like a computer coming alive. John's on the phone saying, "She's right there. She's right there to the right." Directed by his spirit guides from the other side, Edward told Hilland to look in a nearby bathroom. "John's ringing in my ear saying, 'She's right there,' says Hilland, but she wasn't. The only thing he and the other agents and police officers saw was a wall at that point." This is a case where John is insisting, "She's right there," says Hilland. And I'm like, "Hey, pal, I like you and everything, but she's not here. You must be tuning into something else. She's not here." 2 days later, I'm heading back to D.C. and I get this call from one of my colleagues who says, "You're not going to believe this, but one of the cadaver dogs got a hit in the bathroom. We opened up the pipe chase and found her body stuffed in the wall."
Wow, that is incredible.
Yeah. She was exactly where John said she was. For the first time ever, Hilland, a law enforcement veteran of 30 years, and Edward, who's a New York Times bestselling author, former host of the hit TV show Crossing Over with John Edward, and creator of the social media platform Evolve, reveal that they have quietly worked together on many cases for the past 25 years. They chronicle their unorthodox crime-fighting journey in the new book, Chasing Evil, Shocking Crime, Supernatural Forces, and an FBI Agent's Search for Hope and Justice, which is put out by St. Martin Essentials. That book is already out now. So it's available for purchase. There's more to the article, but I tell you what, it's available right now. People Magazine has the article out, so you can check it out on People Magazine. But it's a lot like a lot of the other stories you've heard about John Edward. He's, you know, as far as psychics, they reach out, they get the hit, they connect with the FBI, they find their body. It's pretty impressive.
Yeah.
And of all things, to hear it from John Edward. I'm going to try and reach out because I know John's going to be here in the Twin Cities here in October. So
yeah, that would be amazing.
Yeah. See if I can get him on the show and talk about, you know, see if I can get him to talk about the new book and about working with the FBI, because it's something that I don't think we ever thought we'd see from him. Right. I think we thought he disappeared.
No, but I love it.
Yeah. So interesting stuff.
Super cool.
All right. Last week we had told you about the teenager who became a saint recently. In fact, the Pope Leo, cousin Pope Leo, had his birthday, his 70th birthday this past weekend. Hi, cousin. And happy birthday. But a relic of the Catholic Church's first millennial saint has been stolen already from a Venezuelan parish. Didn't take long. I guess.
Wow. Come on, guys.
Once you get canonized, you're famous, right? The small circular piece of cloth disappeared just 2 days after Pope Leo declared the 15-year-old computer expert Carlos Acutis a saint. We go to Caracas, Venezuela, where a relic of Carlo Acutis was declared the Catholic Church's first millennial saint last week, was stolen from a parish in western Venezuela. The coordinator of a youth group devoted to the man known as God's Influencer confirmed that on Friday. The disappearance of the relic, a small circular piece of cloth, was reported on September 9th by staff of the Santo Domingo de Guzman Parish in Cardinal Quintero Municipality in Mérida State, said Adrian Garcia, the coordinator of the San Carlo Acutis Youth Group. So far, there's no information. It's still missing, Garcia said Friday. We have faith in God that it will appear. It has great spiritual value. The relic, which was housed in a glass reliquary, disappeared just 2 days after Pope Leo XIV declared Acutis a saint. The 15-year-old computer expert who used technology to spread the faith is considered a role model for the next generation of Catholics. The cloth is a third-degree relic, which are usually objects that have touched or been touched by the saint. Police are investigating its disappearance, according to the parish. The Catholic Church has previously denounced the online sale of Carlo Acutis's relics. Acutis was named venerable in 2018. He was then declared blessed in 2020 after the Vatican's saint-making office declared that a child in Brazil who recovered from a pancreatic deformation was scientifically inexplicable and a miracle attributed to Acutis's intercession. Leo canonized Acutis, who died of leukemia in 2006 on September 7th during an open-air mass in St. Peter's Square before an estimated 80,000 people. Nuns on the run, Jess. We talked about nuns being carjacked yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now we have nuns on the run. Three sisters flee from a care home to a remote convent. Three octogenarian nuns have given church authorities the runaround in Austria by fleeing their care home. What sounds like it could be the plot of a whimsical family movie, three elderly nuns have been forced into a care home against their will and have taken a stand against church authorities by fleeing back to an abandoned convent in the Alps. And they're all in their 80s.
Wow. This is like a movie. I love it.
88-year-old sister Bernadette, 86-year-old sister Regina, and 82-year-old sister Rita managed to regain entry to the Kloster Goldenstein Convent in Elsbethen near Salzburg with the help of former students and a locksmith. According to reports, the nuns have been removed from the convent in 2023 against their will and taken to the care home where it was expected that they would remain for the rest of their lives. In a daring move, however, the Defiant Trio managed to escape and return to their former abode. They are now the only three nuns living at the convent. There's nobody else looking after them.
Oh.
They're on their own. Sister Rita said, I am so pleased to be home. I was always homesick at the care home. I'm so happy and thankful to be back. The nuns had spent almost their entire lives at the convent, which has also served as a private school for girls since 1877. One of three even went to the school there herself when she was a child. Not surprisingly, officials aren't too happy with the nuns. According to Provost Marcus Grazel, the building is no longer able to sustain independent living, especially for three nuns in their 80s with various health needs. He described their decision to return there as incomprehensible.
Just get them staff at the home. I mean, just bring them to them. Let them stay there and bring them some health care.
Let them live with dignity, right?
Yeah, they love it there.
Right, right.
Nuns have spunk, though. That I've learned over the years. They are spunky.
They are, yeah. And let them live with some dignity. That's for sure. We had told you about a teen cryptozoologist. One leaves us, another joins us. Mm-hmm. There's an article about a teen cryptozoologist in his search in an uplifting odyssey. Daniel Lee Barnett goes into the woods in search of the big shy guy, but the real story is his family's devotion to supporting their autistic son's passion. So not only is he a teenager, but he's autistic, and he's also out there looking for Bigfoot. 15-year-old Daniel Lee Barnett has been called Britain's youngest cryptozoologist, sniffing out signs of Bigfoot in the woods near his home in Somerset. Daniel has a YouTube channel and a podcast, and he's mates with A-listers in the Bigfoot community. He's spoken in front of crowds of 3,000 enthusiasts, which is even more impressive given Daniel's autistic and as a young child had selective autism, or mutism rather, not autism, but mutism. His dad says he would turn and face the wall if people came into the room. Daniel also co-directs this documentary about his adventures looking for the big shy guy. He first hit headlines in his local area after finding a large footprint in the woods near his home while walking with his Nan Jill, demonstrating just how persistent he is. Daniel contacted DNA companies. Eventually, one offered to test his environmental DNA for free. In among the squirrel and dog DNA, they did find traces of ancient ape. So he was onto something.
No.
In the documentary, he heads off to the wilds of the Pacific Northwest for a Bigfoot hunt. An American colleague makes the point that the Brits have nothing properly scary in their woods. First is the matter of getting on the plane. Daniel is terrified of flying and dysregulates on his first attempt. So it's hard for him just to get on the plane to come over. The real story of the film is the wonderful Barnett family. Daniel's mom, Gemma, says that they've always embraced Daniel's passions and their devotion is a joy to watch. His Nan Jill, his gramps Adrian, are key players in the film. As for the hunt for Sasquatch, it has something for everyone. Bigfoot believers will gasp as the gang reports spotting something big and dark with huge luminous eyes crossing the trail. Smug skeptics will poo-poo the eyewitness accounts and anecdotal evidence, and everyone here is happy. So I'll post this one as well in the description of the program because I want you to check out the trailer for My Bigfoot Life. I find this kid incredibly cool. I really do.
Yes, he's so cool. And he's adorable. Like,
yeah.
How can you not get on board with Daniel? He's the cutest. He's just a really cool kid.
And I wonder, you know, that not to get into this too deep, but with certain children who are on the spectrum, you know, some people want to call it a disability. I don't. I think they're tuned into our world a little bit different than
yeah,
most.
I think so.
And I think maybe he might have a connection with Bigfoot in a way that some others may not. And maybe he's the answer to finally getting evidence of this creature.
He'll be the one.
Yeah, you never know. You never know. All right. Let's see here. As we're beginning to wrap up the program here today, couple more stories here. Great Lakes believe it or not, you know, we've heard of the Bridgewater Triangle out on the East Coast. You've heard of the Bermuda Triangle out there in the ocean. But the Great Lakes has a triangle. In fact, in Lake Michigan. And it's being blamed for disappearances. But they're asking, is the legend true? If you go to Lake Michigan, they say that ships are known to vanish in what's known as the Lake Michigan Triangle. Or do they? The area of Lake Michigan waters between the shores of West Michigan and Wisconsin includes the Great Lakes mysterious region, now known as the Lake Michigan Triangle, drawing comparisons to the infamous Bermuda Triangle, according to the Milwaukee Sentinel Journal. While that doesn't quite hold true, the Great Lakes and certainly Lake Michigan have witnessed an estimated 6,000 shipwrecks, including 1,500 in Michigan waters, according to the Michigan Department of Environment, Great Lakes and Energy. Many wrecks remain on the lake bottom waiting to be discovered. The Great Lakes represents the largest freshwater system in the world and are a major shipping hub with maritime travel dating back several centuries and perilous nautical conditions marked by navigational challenges and seasonal weather. Now, mythology holds that a triangular region on Lake Michigan is a mysterious spot where ships, people, and planes have been known to disappear, in many cases, never to be found. That according to the Great Lakes Museum. Some have dubbed that area the Bermuda Triangle of the Great Lakes, an allusion to the, not illusion, but allusion to similar mysterious spots in the western North Atlantic Ocean between Bermuda, Florida, and Puerto Rico, also famous for alleged disappearances of people, planes, and ships. That according to NOAA's National Ocean Service. So where is this alleged Lake Michigan Triangle? Well, the alleged Lake Michigan Triangle covers an area from Manitowoc, Wisconsin, to Ludington, Michigan, and Benton Harbor, Michigan. The idea of this triangle was popularized in a 1977 book by Jay Gooley called The Great Lakes Triangle, according to Wisconsin maritime historian Brendan Baylod. It later gained traction in the early 1990s by Chicago ghost hunter Richard Crow, who gave supernatural cruises on the Chicago River around Halloween, according to Baylot. Now, contrary to popular tales, people, planes, and ships don't magically vanish in the so-called Lake Michigan Triangle. Some contend mythologizing such events does a disservice to those who lost their lives in maritime disasters. It's not just harmless ghost stories, especially when you're talking about where people die, Baylot said. Lake Michigan is home to the most shipwrecks in all of the Great Lakes, data shows, but that's attributable to the lake's status as a commercial shipping hub between the cities of Chicago, Gary, Indiana, and Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and ports on other Great Lakes or even international destinations. Seasonal weather conditions also play a role, according to David Swayze of the Great Lakes Shipwreck Database and the Michigan Shipwreck Research Association. We don't need to craft aliens or supernatural things, said Valerie Van Heest, who's a Michigan-based author and explorer who has documented many Great Lakes shipwrecks. These lakes are dangerous bodies of water, and that's why they're called the Inland Seas. So the question remains, triangle or dangerous shipping lane? You decide. I don't know. I like to think maybe there's a triangle there.
I like the triangle theory as well. Let's just go with that.
Yeah, we'll go with the triangle. All right, our next story is an unusual one, and I don't know if this is funny or not. An 80-year-old woman was scammed online by a fake astronaut who claimed to be stuck in space.
Oh, it's sad.
A little sad. An 80-year-old Japanese woman ended up sending around 1 million yen or $6,700 to an online scammer who posed as an astronaut stuck in space and in need of money to buy oxygen.
That is a desperate need. I mean, you need oxygen, so I can understand why she gave in.
You tell me how you get the oxygen to someone stuck in space, though.
If you can get the oxygen to them, can you not bring them back?
Right, right? So tell me how that works.
Don't know. We don't always logic, Tim. Sometimes we just have emotions and we feel deeply and we want to help people.
Logic is hard, Jess. Logic is hard.
It can be.
It really can be, can it? I mean, some people just ain't thinking. You know what I mean?
She's thinking with their heart.
Jesus. Trying to get to the rest of the story, but pop up.
She's in her 80s. We're going to cut her so much slack. If it was you that did it, I'd be making fun of you relentlessly. Right?
Now, if I did that, you'd say, Tim, come on. Maybe you're working a little too hard and not thinking straight. Because by God, I'm telling you, I'd expect you to slap me upside the head if I sent money to someone who did that. Hailing from
that money. Give that money to me.
That's right.
I need oxygen too.
I would give you $6,700 and you could go buy Jackie Gleason's house. Hailing from Japan's northern Hokkaido island, the hapless octogenarian reportedly met the scammer on social media back in July, of course. This one wasn't paying her for feet pics, though. They claimed to be a male astronaut on a mission in outer space, and the woman apparently believed them. After earning the trust of their victim, the scammer told her that they were in space on a spaceship right now and that they were under attack and in need of oxygen. First of all, how are they using social media to get a hold of her that they're in space and under attack? Obviously, the only way the 80-year-old woman could do was to send money to a bank account. How are they getting the money from a bank account so that the astronaut could buy more oxygen and survive the ordeal?
So many holes.
Yeah. So bad. Local media outlet Hokkaido Broadcasting reported that the elderly woman lives alone and started developing feelings for the fake astronaut as her conversations progressed. When they asked her for money, she was more than willing to help, despite the absurdity of their claims. She was instructed to deposit the money using prepaid systems, of course, because, you know, Amazon cards for astronauts that need oxygen. It sounds plausible, right?
Yeah, that doesn't work in space, so yeah.
Yeah. She was instructed to deposit the money using prepaid systems at five different stores, of course. Yeah, between August and July, or July and August, and she only told her family about it when she started realizing that something was off. It was only after she had gone to the five stores, Jess, that something was wrong.
Bless her heart.
Mm. After discussing it with family, the woman reported the bizarre case to the police. She was told that this was a common type of online romance scheme. Really, she fell in love with an astronaut that was running out of oxygen.
I mean, who doesn't, Tim?
God damn it. And that her money back, getting her money back was virtually impossible. Why? Because he's up in space. That's why.
And also, he's not real.
Well, he's probably dead. He has no oxygen. She waited too long. The police decided to make the woman's case public as a warning to other vulnerable people who might be targeted by scammers at some point. That and the fact that she was incredibly stupid to send off $6,700. Believe it or not, as strange as it sounds, this type of astronaut scam is not unheard of in Japan. Back in 2022... another elderly woman paid $30,000 to a scammer posing as an astronaut stuck in space to help them return to Earth.
Well, they must really, like, just think astronauts are just, you know, flying around up there haphazardly. Like, they're not tied to any governmental, you know, controls.
Yeah.
Or...
Yeah.
That's very odd to me. I mean, I don't think you could do that to someone in the U.S. because I think we would assume, well, NASA will take care of them, right?
Do they think there's a Western Union floating around on a satellite that they're just going to pick up the money and then spend it with?
Oh,
who?
I feel so bad for them. And they're like, oh my God, my boyfriend's an astronaut. This is lit.
This is lit. I'm really going to help them. And then what? Does the interstellar welder come by and then weld their little ship together so that they can come home?
Yet he can't get home.
No, he's like, not. He's not going
to
get
home. You know, you can get all the stuff to him, but he can't get home.
Turns out the Camel Towing doesn't have a spaceship tow truck out there to get them back. They got to fix it themselves.
Yeah.
Yeah. And our palate cleanser for today, Jess, because if that didn't piss you off enough to want a palate cleanser, nothing will. I get irate just reading that story. That
I know. You feel so bad for people.
I don't feel like... I don't feel bad.
I feel bad for the people getting scammed because they're gullible. Yes, it's stupid and annoying, but also like they're old. So they don't, they can't process all of it. I mean, I can't process all of it, and I'm not in my 80s yet, Tim.
Jess, if I had any age, go, oh yeah, you're stuck in space, I'll send you money. I want you to take all my devices away. I want you to replace me on the show immediately with one of my relatives. Lock me away in an old folks home and have me talk to the wall, and I'm going to eat Jell-O for the rest of my life. Because I'm done. I'm done as a human being. I have nothing to give society anymore. If I think that somehow if I send money to an astronaut in space who's stranded out there and they have no oxygen, that somehow my money is going to help them get oxygen.
Yeah, I know. It's so foolish. I'll just be like, Tim, just take this camera, take more pictures of your foot.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'll take pictures of my Charco foot for you so you can make some money, okay?
Make you rich.
Yep, I'll make you rich in your spare time. With that, I need a palate cleanser. Yes.
Yeah, let's have it.
Okay. I figured out a way to separate my chipmunks and figure out who's who.
Okay.
I mean, I know them by sight. I know which one is which.
Did you get them little sweaters with like their name letter on the front, like Alvin and the Chipmunk style?
That is a sin. You do not put sweaters on chipmunks.
I would.
No, no. You know, intern Yoko had this idea a while back, and I thought it was, I was like, don't you dare do that. And she did it. You want to know what it was?
Yeah, I'm going to love it because I love everything she does.
She took different color paints and she would put a little dab of paint on their tail. And I said,
yes, I said, that's smart.
No, it's toxic. I said, stop painting the chipmunks.
Well, I mean, it depends on what kind of paint it is. It's not all toxic.
It was water-based, but still she was like putting like little dabs of paint on them when they would come by. She'd dab their tail and paint in different colors so she knew which one was which.
Yeah, that's just smart.
Someone's been painting squirrels red and blue in Connecticut, Jess.
See, she's not the only one.
Local authorities have been scratching their heads after footage emerged of unusually colored mammals. Residents of East Hartford couldn't believe their eyes recently when a pair of squirrels, one of them bright blue, the other bright red, were spotted roaming around the area.
Oh, I hope you have pictures of this.
I do. Good. Here is a squirrel that looks like Cookie Monster right there.
Oh my gosh. You're so bright blue. That is amazing. I want one.
You want a bright blue squirrel?
Yeah.
My thing is, how do you get them to stay still long enough to paint them like that? Because the chipmunk would run the minute that intern Yoko had the paintbrush. I mean, she had to like flick and hit him in the tail real quick as he was running away. How do you get a squirrel to, I mean, do you hit him with a super soaker full of paint?
I mean, maybe, or they're just like very covert and they're like in camo and they're like hiding in the bushes and stuff. And they've got their little spray can and they're just like really quick.
So you spray paint a whole bush that's got or a whole tree that's got a, but then you got red and blue. So, I mean, you got it like, that's a colorful tree.
I mean, that's a lot of effort on someone's part. I'm impressed.
Footage of the pair quickly appeared online, leading to questions being raised over exactly how the animals had ended up with such unusual coloration and who might be responsible. At first, it was believed that the footage was AI generated, but this turned out not to be the case. Instead, it appears as though the two squirrels have been deliberately painted bright colors. East Hartford Animal Control. Oh my God, this other one looks like Elmo. I'm going to show you in a second. East Hartford Animal Control maintains that the pair are none the worse for wear, but the hunt is currently on for whoever might have done this, Jess. This right here. It looks like the Elmo and Cookie Monster of the squirrel world.
Oh my gosh. That is amazing. So their heads aren't painted. So that's good. So they didn't get in their eyes or in their mouths.
They probably held
their
them.
Backsides.
But here's the bad thing. They probably held them by the head in order to paint them.
Or do you think they like caught them in like some sort of humane trap? And then they're like just making them all colorful
you'd
and then they
to
let
catch
them go.
You'd have to catch them in a live trap and you'd have to airbrush them. Yeah. That's
their art.
Air gun. Yeah. That's how you'd have to do it. The question of why someone would do this is also high on the agenda for police. Whatever the case may be, they might be in serious trouble if the law catches up to them, as doing this to the squirrels could constitute animal cruelty and fetches a $1,000 fine and even a stint in prison. That's right, you can do prison time for coloring your squirrel.
You can get in bigger trouble for coloring your squirrel than like leaving your kids in the car.
Yes, yes, you can. Yep. Kill the kids in the car. It doesn't matter when you go into the...
I just remember one story that you told me that a lady left her kids in the car and she went and did something and like they were in there forever and she like barely got in trouble.
Yeah, it's like a $250 fine or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. But by God, color the squirrels in the park, $1,000.
Yeah.
Yeah.
$1,000.
Yeah. I better tell John Ryoko that. Don't paint the chipmunks. $1,000.
No, she's going to get in so much trouble.
Yeah.
Don't you turn her in.
I'm not saying anything.
I'm on Yoko's side.
Yeah. No, she should stop putting paint on the chipmunks. I know who they are. I'm out there every day feeding them.
I'm going to knit them all sweaters.
Don't you dare. Here's the thing. God gave them enough fur so that they can stay warm. They don't need a sweater. That's my argument.
He looks so cute. God.
Do you think they honestly want it? You know what? I have a little bed for Spud. I bought a little. Have you seen Spuddy's bed?
Yes. Yes. I mean, you treat them like humans. They're so confused right now because they're naked. They're like, he's not naked. They look at you and they're like, well, Dad's not naked. Why am I naked?
Spuddy has a pillow and blanket. And you know what Spuddy uses the blanket for?
What?
Hiding peanuts.
Oh.
And cherries. And you know how I know this? Because the other day I said, oh, Spuddy, you're all out of cherries. You know what she did? She lifted up the blanket, took out a cherry, and started eating it.
My God.
I was like, you're supposed to use the blanket to stay warm, honey. You can't. And she's like, what's stay warm? I got fur.
I mean, she's just like a child. My kids do that. I go up there and I find all this food in their bedrooms. I'm like, what's happening in here?
It's under the blanket.
Yeah.
Yeah. So she hid a cherry under the blanket.
I will say, you know, some animals don't like to be clothed. Phoebe Buffay, for example, hates it. She gets so angry when you put a sweater on her, but she looks so darn cute. And it actually is cuter when she's mad. But our dog, Indiana Jones, who's no longer with us, he loved his sweaters. He would go get a sweater and bring it to you and drop it in front of you and wait for you to put it on him. And then he would huff up his chest. Mm-hmm. Like he knew, like, all the people are wearing clothes and now I'm one of you. So, I mean, you should really just talk to your critters and ask them if they would like me to knit them a sweater. And if they say yes, I'll do that for you.
I'll throw it out there, but I'll tell you this much. I have a feeling Spud's probably anti-sweater because the minute I said I held out my... People are going to think I'm nuts now because I'm talking to the chipmunks. I was out there yesterday with her. I was filling up the dishes and she was watching me fill up the dishes. And I was telling her, you know, I met baby Bennett, right? We have a new baby in the family. And I showed a picture of me holding the baby. And I swear at that moment, she got jealous because she came down off her perch and came right down to look at the phone right by the dish. And I think she thought that baby was competition for her food. I think she got not only jealous, but she got pissed.
Yeah.
She's like, is that baby going to take my food? And then I'm like, no. This is a human baby. It's a human baby. And no, he's not coming over to get your food. You're safe. And then I said to her, you're still my baby.
Yes.
And then she was like, oh, okay, cool. All right. So in that, Jess, I think if I heard her say, hey, can I put clothes on you? She'd go, you stupid. No. You already gave me a blanket and I put food under it. What do you think I'm going to do with clothes? I'm probably going to stuff food under my shirt.
Oh, no.
Unless it's cargo pants. And then fine. Yeah. She probably loved cargo pants because there'd be plenty of pockets. Oh, can you hear me? Can you hear me now? Oh, I can't hear you. Oh, Hold on. Can you hear me now?
There you are. You're back.
Sorry
about that.
No, that's okay. That was my. So unless it was cargo pants, unless you gave her cargo pants, she'd love cargo pants because you can put peanuts and cherries in cargo pants.
Lots of pockets. And you could get her a hoodie sweatshirt. She could put nuts in her hood and a little kangaroo pouch pocket.
Yeah. Yeah. She'd love that. She'd think that would be awesome.
We'll go shopping on Temu. I really feel like we could find all of these clothes out there on Temu.
Was it you and I that were talking about this, or was it me and Mally that were talking about
the little hamster clothes? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It'd work.
I shouldn't do it. She'll hate me forever. She would never stay still enough long enough for me to put the clothes on her.
Probably not. That would be the problem, getting them in them.
Yeah. I digress. All right. Tomorrow on the program, we should end up with this nonsense. I'm talking about a pipe dream here. I'm never going to get clothes on Spud. It's just a pipe dream. It's like peace in the Middle East. It's never going to happen. Tomorrow on the big program, a couple old friends stop by. We're talking Mothman. You know, this weekend, Jess, is the Mothman Festival in Point Pleasant, West Virginia.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we celebrate by also talking about a brand new book that is out there. Brand new Mothman book that is out there by Richard Estep and Tobias Whalen. It's been released by Llewellyn Books, this brand new Mothman book. And the two have collaborated on this Mothman book, and it's out now. So we're going to talk about it. We're talk about this new Mothman book that they have out.
I can't wait to read it.
Yeah. So it's out. It's available. And we're going to talk Mothman with the two experts. So, yeah, got a big show tomorrow. And
be a good one.
Yeah. And we've got a lot of stuff coming down the pike. A lot of good stuff coming down the pike. It's September into October. We're right in the middle of spooky season, aren't we?
Yeah, this is our time to shine, Tim.
Yeah. So lots of good stuff coming. So, yeah. I've been told that people were creeped out a little bit by our guest, Andy, the other day, the UFO guest.
Oh, really? Why?
Well, I mean, not just the different UFO cases, but in his own UFO experience, but it was the Scottish accent, I think. It was a little hard to follow. I loved Andy. I had a good time with him. So, yeah.
Are they just more accustomed to your fake Scottish accent?
Yes.
They like it better.
They thought I was being offensive, but no, then they actually heard Andy's real Scottish accent and went, oh, you were dead on.
You're spot on.
Yeah. No, I had a good time with Andy, so I'm hoping to get him back on the program. So we could talk UFOs again, but he was really, really fun. A lot of fun. Fun to talk to off air too. So yeah, but hopefully we'll bring Andy back in the next couple of months. Talk more.
That'd be awesome. You do get us some fun guests, Tim.
Yeah. So we're going to tomorrow, Richard Estep, Tobias Whalen. We'll be talking Mothman. And then I think we're getting back on the ghosty train here soon. We've been heavy into cryptids and UFOs lately, but I think we'll bring it back around the bend. Time for Halloween here, so
perfect.
But there may be some more monsters in there too.
I mean, I love it all, so I feel like you can't go wrong. Whatever you throw at me, I'm listening and I'm loving it, and I'm a happy girl.
I know this much: before Halloween, I want to try to get haunted dolls. Yeah, I want to try to get one show on haunted dolls. So
yes.
That's coming up as well. So any suggestions you guys have, tim@darknessradio.com. So if you have a suggestion for a guest, don't just say, hey, you know what would be really cool, Tim? Go out and get the Dalai Lama and then leave it that, you know, in my email, and then not leave me with some contact info because that's rather rude. But, you know, if you have a suggestion for a guest and maybe a way to contact them, leave it tim@darknessradio.com. The executive producer of today's program is Troy Palmer. Troy, thank you for everything you do. Second, you know, there's a new iOS update, iOS 26 for iPad, iPhone, iWatch, ayahuasca, whatever it is you're using. That's all coming up here relatively shortly. So there may be a little bit of... a little bit of rocky waters coming up here soon. Just bear with us as we make that switch over to the new iOS on our app. All right. But stay with us because we'll get that updated for you. Also, if you're listening to this program, not watching it, it's the Original Darkness Radio on YouTube. You can also watch the program at darknessradioshow.com. That'll do it for this program. Join us tomorrow, Tobias Wayland and Richard Estep. For Jessica Freeberg, I'm Tim Dennis. Thank you so much for watching and listening to the best in paranormal programming. This is Darkness Radio.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.